So in any event, yeah. Wait, do you want to take it out? I mean, late 2015?
Well, Mike, I think what's important is sort of the foundation to any house, the house we're building. And that foundation, you know, dates back several years before my dear friend and partner Larry here and I engage in filing a whistleblower case on a tax-exempt organization to the IRS in Ogden, Utah, August 1st, 2017. Previous to that, we had been solicited by a number of different people. We met with them, people from, you know, very high profile and wealthy people who are across the nation who really were looking to get to the bottom line of what all this Clinton Foundation was about. And Larry and I didn't know anything about the Clinton Foundation other than what we read in the paper, too, and really had no reason to. So none of this is personal. I personally don't know the Clintons. I've never met them. They may be nice people. I have no idea. I've never met them. But they may not be nice people. I have no idea. But what we do is make cases. And, you know, what happens is, these folks are all reaching out to us and saying, hey, can you guys look into this? And we get in a plane and we travel around the country and Larry and I came back and said, the level of interest is astounding. People want to pay us to do this. And we got back and said, you know what? Enough. Enough with all these people. You know, they all want to know and they have different angles and this and that. We're both independent voters. You know, why don't we just look at this thing ourselves? So Larry and I make a commitment. Let's look at this thing ourselves. And we say we'll put up our own money to travel or do whatever. And that's exactly what we did. So we start out of our own interests in self-funding, and it's always been that way. We've never had anybody fund us, and every dime of that's been spent on this is us. What is going on here? And so we start to really develop information. Go ahead, Larry, you can jump in. You know?
You know, the Clinton Cash Book written by Peter Schweitzer had come out in May of 2015. Hillary Clinton had, announced that she'd be running for presidency in 2016. So, you know, there were lots of unknowns, right? Who was going to win the presidential election? Big unknown. I mean, I guess we start looking into this. If she ends up winning the election, I mean, said, okay, we'll put a year's worth of work into it, and it will be for naught, because if she's the president, nobody's going to, you know, give this the time of day. But it was very methodical. We opened up some spreadsheets and developed some, and look, literally, if you look into a 990, a tax return that any not-for-profit has to file, a 990, I mean, they've got the income statements. But then there are about, 10 to 12 different schedules. Schedule B is a listing of all the major donations. And so we start looking into literally every schedule and then reconciling them, because each piece of information is like a clue. And you start developing here we are, cripes, going almost 5 years now, and we realize, like, my God, this is an 8,000-piece puzzle that, back 5 years ago, we had no idea that it was 8,000 pieces. But at the time, you just start laying out all these pieces and you start connecting them. And each one says, okay, what did I learn and where does it lead me, right? And you look at some of the donations and then you say, okay, you go to their listing of donors that are on their website, and you try to reconcile things. And so you just start laying it out, and each becomes a path. And does it reconcile? Does it add up? You look at their net assets each year, and then you compare year by year, and you start just laying all this stuff out and building these spreadsheets. And it was fascinating. I mean, it was fascinating. And so we go from there, all their federal forms, to then we start soliciting in late 2016 into 2017 all the state registration forms that they filed. And just literally collecting endless amounts of information. I mean, we probably killed a lot of trees in terms of, you know, paper.
Right.
But, again, looking at all the questions on the state registration forms and realizing, oh, you know what? Early on in the life of this foundation, they were faced with some consent decrees in various states for not properly registering. Do they acknowledge that fact on other state registration forms? You say, oh, they're not acknowledging that, and that's stated under penalty of perjury. So these start to become, you know, what might initially be viewed as minor red flags. That when you see the repeated numbers, dozens upon dozens, and then hundreds upon hundreds of times, becomes some major red flags. And as John knows better than me, you know, when people are loose with the truth, it leads to problems and further questions and inquiry. And so we just started, you know, literally going down all these different paths. And then you look into the foundation, you see some of their programs that they launched and the consortiums that they launched early on, and you try to reconcile that with the statements that they filed with the IRS in terms of their, you know, initial articles of incorporation, the determination letters that they were receiving, what was on file at the National Archives. So everything gets cross-referenced 2, 3, 4 different times. What adds up? What doesn't add up? Leads to further questions. So this is, you know, just a multi-level pursuit. And what's interesting also, Michael, is that when you engage different people at different federal agencies or different states or also overseas, they're looking at this primarily from their perspective. You know, it's just straight on. We're looking at it from a 180-degree, if not actually a 360-degree perspective. And when you start getting into it and you realize we have more information than they do, and utilizing that approach to ask questions and to gather even more information, all done, no bias, just looking for the truth, you know, is there a case to be made? That's all it was. All part of this 8,000-piece puzzle that we're working on putting together, and we had the benefit of time. And you know, and again, I don't want to go on too much, but then November 8th happened in 2016 and everything changed, right? Then our year's worth of effort was like, okay, game on. She didn't win. And, you know, we received a very interesting phone call the morning of November 9th. We had reached out in early October, a month before the election, to the CFO of the organization. And we've referenced this in our congressional hearing. That CFO, a fellow by the name of Andrew Kessel, was an acquaintance of mine from Wall Street. I figured, okay, you know what? Cast the line. And then reaching out to Andy, left a message, pointedly made a point of telling him that I was working with John, because he might think, oh, what the heck is Larry Doyle, you know, an old Wall Street buddy, what's he calling me for, and just dismiss it.
Right.
But I made a point of putting John's name into the voicemail and including, you know, the firm that John had and the type of work in terms of investigative work, you know, an international money laundering expert, so that he could say, who is this guy, and go look him up. So that he could never come back and say, hey, these guys ticked me off. So that was, again, everything is above board and very straightforward. And at 9:45 on November 9th, you know, Andy's out in Little Rock, so it's 8:45. It had to have been one of his first phone calls. I think it's, who is it, Podesta, John Podesta conceded, gave the concession speech Clinton, I think, the night before. That was only like 4 hours before that, right? 4 or 5 hours before that. I mean, had to have been one of the first phone calls that Andy Kessel made. Hey, Larry, how you know, and I was like, oh, interesting night. And he said, we'd love to get together. We've got, I'm working with John. We get people asking about what's going on with the foundation. We booked breakfast for November 30th at the Princeton Club in New York City. That was a very interesting breakfast.
So he right away, out of the shoot, he's like the day after the election, he was feeling a little nervous.
I was in my office, and, operating in about 2 to 3 hours of sleep. You want to get up and catching the morning news. And I looked in the window of my phone, and I remember thinking, like, oh, my God. You see Clinton Foundation pop up in the window of the phone. It's like, and you just realize, that guy, I got to be one of his first calls. And why would he call me one of the first calls? Well, let's put it this way. He had some things that he wanted to get off his chest. And we've testified under oath to the statements that he made. And he did, in terms of providing very incriminating material in terms of how the foundation operated, and the mixing and matching of funds, and the expense abuse, and the fact that he and others brought this to President Clinton's attention time and again, and there was no talking to him. This is private inurement. Yeah, the abuse of charitable donations.
And his name is on a lot of the documents.
Andy's name is on most of the state registration forms and federal tax returns,
yeah,
all filed under penalty of perjury.
Well, we know he's lawyered up since the feds have talked to him. I mean, I know that much. I don't know if I'm sure you might be able to corroborate that or not, but
he's still at the foundation.
Yeah.
As we departed that morning, it was interesting. Andy said, you know what, let's stay in touch. Do me a favor, call me on my cell phone. Like, okay, thank you very much. And but he was, we brought up the fact that there were some internal reviews that the foundation had undertaken on its own, both in late 2008 and then again in late 2011. And Andy acknowledged the fact that those internal reviews and our studying of those reviews, I mean, again, they were also very incriminating in terms of, before you do anything else, I mean, late 2008, the foundation's been in business for 10 years at that point. Their own lawyers are like, before you do anything else, you got to get in compliance with the law. You're not compliant. I mean, if that's not a damning statement, I don't know what is. It goes on to, abuse, expense abuse, and all sorts of other stuff. And then in 2011, nothing had changed. And indications that, donors' expectations of quid pro quo. This is serious stuff. You have to assume that the people at the foundation figured those things would never see the light of day. But they did. Andy acknowledged those facts. And so there's a consistency throughout all our efforts. The federal returns, the state, the interviews, the documents that we sourced overseas, email exchanges that we sourced, conversations between foundation officials and foreign government officials. There's a consistency throughout this in terms of the abuse of the tax codes, various rules and regulations that the IRS imposes on charitable organizations. And there was just the way that I look at it, a brazen disregard. It was this just like, you know what? We're going to run this operation however we want, figuring that nobody's ever going to seriously look into us. Well, guess what? Me and John, we seriously looked into them, and not our opinion, just the facts.
Let me let me ask John a question. John, you work Colombian cartel cases and stuff. You don't have to go into the specifics. I wouldn't put you on the spot, but I know some of the cases you guys worked on because I was running with those guys and things, and I'm still friends with those, a lot of those guys. We've been friends for a long time, going on 30 years, I guess, now. We're getting fucking old. How long into this did you start to realize this is being run like a cartel? I don't want to put words in your mouth. Would you consider it run like a cartel?
Well, it's a great question. Because once we sourced out the primary documents that, once again, are filed by the entity, not filed by us, filed by the entity, what you really look for is a footprint, right? So, you know, you and your wife get married and it's your first house. You need at least one bedroom, maybe two for visitors. So your footprint is smaller, right? Right. Then all of a sudden you start to have children and your footprint, you know, your family's growing. You need a bigger footprint, right? So the footprint really, from the analytics, gives you a better idea of the construct of the operation. So as your family grows, now we have grammar school and this one's going out, and then you got Little League and you got basketball games and you got all these activities, and now your footprint in relationships are growing bigger. But when you look at the source documents, we start to see the footprint. And those source documents are identifying, right, cash flow and expenses. And when you see the level of growth from the initiation of the approval for a library, you see certain levels of income. But as you see those levels of income grow, and you see the library completed, no different than your house and your family, those cash flows continue. The footprint is growing. So what are you doing with all this money? Okay. Like, where's it going? So it's at that point, when you compare it, per your question, it really, the analytics starts to make you think, oh, wait a minute. This is a much bigger operation than a library, a $35 million library. That's when your antenna goes up and say, wait a minute, let me go back to the other source documents. IRS application 1023 form. What did you apply for? And then you look at what's going on in the cash flows. What were you approved for? You go back and you look. Be approved for 1, 2, 3, 1, XYZ, well, just specifically, becomes very granular. And when you hold true to the granular nature of what the application was made by the foundation, what the approval was by the IRS, you now have a playing field. And is that playing field reconciling with the footprint? Right? If you're a drug organization and you're running a coffee business, is the cash flows that you recognize, is that reconciling to the footprint of the facilities you own? It's those disparities and those variations that really pique your curiosity. That's when you start to see a case. When we started to see the cash flows as large as they were, yet the approval was for a library, penalty flag. It's at that point you start to see there's something else going on here. There's something else going on here. You're not just producing coffee. Something else is going on here. You're not just funding a library, because you already did that in your first couple of years. You already funded that. you put your 25% overhead allocation when it goes to NARA, right? National Archives, takes over all presidential libraries. That's transferred to the federal government. But the cash flows continue. What else is going on here? But to that point, in our analysis, that we know this has got to be reviewed. Why? Because you go back to the application, very granular, and the approval. Are you living within that? Having done so many cases of 501c3s across the country, this arena is an atrocity. The violations within the 501c3 arena are so bad. It is such an abuse of a privilege that's bestowed upon an applicant to get a tax advantage, which is subsidized by taxpayers. You have at least a federal, if you're producing revenue at the 35 to 39%, taxable rate on top of state, maybe your city, that is the head start you get to the tax-exempt organization. Okay? When you get that, you need to live within what the IRS has approved for you to live in. You live in that footprint. When we see revenues expanding well beyond that defined footprint, then we know there's a problem. And we saw the revenues that day. That's when we knew.
And Michael, I mean, just, again, kind of starting, going back to the early years, you know, as John states, this was commissioned to build a presidential library. But there were two huge developments, one in 2002 with the launch of a Geneva-based World Health Organization affiliate called the Global Fund for AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, which so happens that that Chelsea Clinton wrote both her thesis and then 10, 12 years later writes her dissertation on the Global Fund. So, you know, how about that? So the Global Fund for AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, you know, funded by, you know, largely developed countries, the United States providing by charter a third of their funding, and that's over the course of the last 18 years, $60 billion. So the U.S. has been you know, committed approximately $20 billion to that. That gets launched, and then shortly thereafter, George W. Bush, President Bush, announces a program under the USAID umbrella called PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. And that was going to be a huge money initiative. And there's been, you know, upwards of $60, $70 billion of U.S. government funds. So when we kind of lay out all these different puzzle pieces, I look at those as kind of like the right tackle and the left tackle, if we could use a football analogy. And all of a sudden, you start seeing outfits like the Clinton Foundation and many others who are just like, you know what, we're just going to kind of ride the, you know, just get right behind these guys, you know, meaning the Global Fund and PEPFAR. And we're going to just kind of, you know, we're going to trail them. And so what's interesting about the Global Fund is, and as well as USAID, when Hillary Clinton becomes Secretary of State in 2009, USAID, you know, previously would report to an undersecretary and then the undersecretary to the Secretary of State. In 2009, USAID reported directly to Hillary Clinton with no IG in place. And we ran a review of all, you know, through the State Department's FOIA website. Also of interest was the Global Fund during that time period was rocked with, you know, meaningful amounts of fraud, allegations of fraud, and we read all their IG reports. And so the State Department actually sent some folks over to Geneva. And what were they sent over there? To help them with the messaging around these frauds, because the donor countries, Sweden and Norway, and like, what the hell is going on? So the State Department sends these people over not to find out what the heck is going on, but to help them with their messaging. And a Washington-based, good government outfit called the Government Accountability Project, draws up a letter and states unequivocally, that the State Department was, acting in a collusive, corrupt fashion with the Global Fund that, cost American taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars. Again, these aren't our opinions. These are documented facts and documented evidence. We have those documents. So these are, again, when we talk about red flags, those are major red flags. Also in Geneva, along with the Global Fund, is another World Health Organization affiliate called Unitaid. And while, many people are thinking, okay, who's the biggest donor to the Clinton Foundation? Is it, the Ukraine or, different Qatar or Saudi Arabia? Actually, this outfit, Unitaid, which is, kind of a mirror image of the Global Fund. Again, it provides financing for developing countries for pharmaceutical purposes. The Clinton Foundation is the largest recipient of Unitaid funds. Unitaid's about a $3 billion outfit. The Clinton Foundation has received $700 million. The most interesting thing, though, from our perspective about Unitaid, 70% of those funds don't come from, the donor government. It actually comes from an airline tax. So if you're going through the airport in France or selected African nations or selected other, nations around the world, you don't even realize it, but Unitaid's got their hand in your pocket and 70%. So it's like, okay, you know what? The Clinton Foundation received $700 million from Unitaid, 70%. So you could say $500 million goes to the Clinton Foundation from consumer airline travelers. Dare I say, if some of the people wearing yellow vests over in France were fully aware of that, they might be sufficiently pissed off.
Well, just let me recap real quick, guys, because you guys have already put the puzzle pieces together. I understand how they're fitting now, but I just want to point out, so to the folks out there that don't have a background of chasing scoundrels for decades. You have Unitaid, you have the Global Fund, you have USAID, which is an arm of the United States, and they send money to these places overseas, and those places kick money to the Clinton Foundation. And this all goes on while Hillary Clinton is in charge of deciding how much money and what money goes where from USAID. So she's basically laundering money back into her foundation. And of course, it's more complicated than that. I think when you look at USAID and then you look at other places like the CDC and we get into pharmaceuticals, it gets even more complicated about where the Clinton Foundation is getting their money from. And so it's a fancy scheme that probably nobody would even know about if it wasn't for you guys. Is that accurate? Is my assessment of that accurate?
Mike, it's a matter of follow the money. You have recapped it. We have filed what amounts to a probable cause memo with the IRS, recapping what you just said. And that's exactly what we're doing. We're following that path of money. And the path of money has led us to really what we call an ecosystem of people all related to one another, not familial, but in terms of political relationships, people having worked for years within administrations together.